Bhavatu sahanau bhunaktu sahavidyan karavavahai tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Excuse me. Sorry. Welcome back. Welcome also to the many students attending this class regularly online. We continue our study of chapter 3 of Uddhava Gita, 23 of Uddhava Gita. The topic of the entire chapter is jnanam, but tricky. When we use this word jnanam in Advaita Vedanta, it doesn't mean knowledge in the conventional sense. So knowledge in the conventional sense is knowledge of something. You are the knower, and something is known to you. That's absolutely inapplicable in Advaita Vedanta, because first of all, the subject matter is not something. The subject matter is your true nature. Atma. Secondly, where you can have knowledge of a thing, you can't have knowledge of Atma because you are Atma. Atma is not a thing that you can gain knowledge of. You can gain knowledge of a chair, of a body, of many things, but Atma is not out there or in here available to be known as an object. So it might be better to, we call it jnanam because it's the removal of ignorance, the removal of the so-called veil of ignorance that prevents you from recognizing your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, that so-called inner divinity. So this knowledge is the discovery. That's a nice, I like that word discovery somehow. Because when you discover something, it's already there. It's already been there. It's been there for a long time. When did Atma, this is a nice question. When did Atma become Satchidananda? Didn't, right? Watch this. When did Atma become enlightened? Wait a minute. You're getting this. Yeah. So enlightenment is not for Atma. When we say that your true nature is divine, that's a beginningless reality. It's an eternal reality. To be enlightened is to discover who you already are. We have to use words very carefully here, but that's accurate. To be enlightened is to discover who you are, who you've always been, and what you always will be. That pure consciousness, unchanging, unbounded, limitless, vast, that so-called inner divinity. So to make that discovery is to be enlightened. And with that, we can see the next verse in which Sri Krishna describes that condition of being enlightened based on what we've just discussed. This is in the longer meter. Listen and repeat. Samahitai ka ka karanair gunatma bhir. Samahitai ka karanair gunatma bhir. Guno bhaven mat suvivikta dhamnaha. Guno bhaven mat suvivikta dhamnaha. Vikshipyamanar hutakim nudushanam. Vikshipyamanar hutakim nudushanam. Ghanar hupetar vigatai hrave kim. Dhanair kum. Tire, vigor, tire, good, kim. in the second line. And mat suvivikta dhamnaha. Talking about one who has discovered. Mat suvivikta dhamna. Mat is a pronoun me, Sri Krishna, describing my dhamna. Dhaman, my abode. One is describing the enlightened person as one who has discovered my abode. What kind of abode? Abode? Suvivikta. Separate in a sense of very different. Different than any kind of human abode. Very different because this abode is not out there. This abode is here. It's your true nature. So Sri Krishna, yes, Sri Krishna, Ishvara is everywhere, but that all-pervasive Ishvara is discovered within. This is Advaita Vedanta. So one who has discovered that truth, Matsuvivikta Dhaman, one who has discovered Sri Krishna's presence within you as your own true self, Satchidananda Atma. What about that person? For that person, Sri Krishna asks, first line, kaha, and second line, gunaha. Kaha, gunaha. What is the, here guna means like benefit, something that's good. Kaha, gunaha. What is the benefit? The benefit for someone who has discovered my abode within, Sri Krishna asks, kaha gunaha, what is the benefit of samahitaihi karanaihi, of concentrating, samahita, concentrating your karana, your senses which are guna, atmabihi, which are made of three gunas, what is the purpose, what is the benefit, stay with the word guna, what is the benefit of concentrating your attention, of concentrating your senses? Patanjali in his Yoga Sutra speaks very, points to the great importance of the practice of pratyahara, sense withdrawal. After all, how can you discover Sri Krishna's presence within when you're looking all around, when you're so extrovert in life? So, obviously, for the sake of enlightenment, one of the very first steps is to control your senses sufficiently so that you can turn your attention within. Here Sri Krishna says, but after you're enlightened, what's the benefit of controlling your senses? The practice has already been done. Practice is a means to the end, right? So once you've done the practice, you don't have to continue it any further. There is a famous moment in this Razor's Edge book, and it's been made into a movie, Somerset Maugham. Special moment is where the protagonist, who has become enlightened, he met Ramana Maharshi, and he's at the top of a mountain. He's become enlightened and is getting very cold. He brought all of his books with him up on top of the mountain, and he doesn't find any need to study them because he's already enlightened. The weather has gotten very cold, so what does he do? Page by page, he starts burning the books. All of his scriptures that he brought with him. The point is, once you're enlightened, the means that led you to enlightenment, the discipline, the practices, are no longer necessary. So Sri Krishna says, when you have truly discovered my presence within you, then there's no further necessity of restraining your senses. Which means what? Means you can enjoy a nice cup of coffee. Why not? And he further makes that point in the third line. He said, wait a minute, enlightened people can enjoy a cup of coffee? My guru loved coffee. So here, Sri Krishna continues this in the third line. He says, Vikshipyamanaihi uta kim na dushanam uta. Or, kim nu dushanam, what's the opposite of benefit is harm. So guna is benefit, dushana or dosha here is some harm. So Sri Krishna says, kim nu dushanam, what is the harm for that enlightened person? What is the harm in vikshipyamanaihi, in having the mind distracted? Which means, like, distracted in a sense of enjoyment. Do you think enlightened people never enjoy anything? Never seek? I'll stay with my guru's example for a while. He used to love watching cricket on TV. And cricket, and he didn't watch football much. He watched tennis for some reason. He loved to watch tennis. So cricket and tennis. He would spend hours, especially the cricket games, when they're in India, that means late at night in this country. So he'd be watching all night. He'd be watching his cricket games. What's Sri Krishna says, kim nu dushanam, what's the harm? Maybe before enlightenment, if all you're doing is watching cricket games, you're never going to get enlightened. But that's not the context that Sri Krishna is talking about here. He's talking about after enlightenment. And there's a very important point being made here, and that is many people tend to have unrealistic images of an enlightened person. Someone who has completely transcended the world to such an extent that they certainly can't relate to a cricket game, certainly can't enjoy a cup of coffee. They've transcended all that. Well, you get the message here. An enlightened person is a human being. And staying with my guru, you may have heard me give this example before. He had an interesting definition of an enlightened person, given the fact that an enlightened person remains a human being. Then he defined an enlightened person in this way. An enlightened person is a normal person, he said. And then he would add, the only normal person. You get the point? So enlightenment is getting rid of all of this mental weirdness, all of the ignorance. So then this verse ends. Sri Krishna gives a metaphor. Vedanta is full of metaphors. And here the metaphor is ganaihi upetaihi vigataihi va ravehi kim. Kim, what difference does it make? Ravehi. For Ravi, the sun. What difference does it make to the sun when ghana here means clouds? When those clouds, upetaihi, upeta, when the clouds come, vigataihi, or when they go? What difference does it make to the sun when clouds come and go? Very famous metaphor we've used many times. And you may have heard here, I've used it in the context of clouds of sadness, clouds of pain, clouds of misery. All these clouds can come into the mind. How does it affect consciousness? How does it affect the consciousness that reveals the presence of those clouds of sadness? So can an enlightened person get sad? Is an enlightened person normal? Do normal people get sad? Yeah, an enlightened person gets sad. But the sadness for an enlightened person is like the cloud. If you go out on a cloudy day, do you feel bad because the sun is destroyed? You know the sun continues to shine. The enlightened person knows that in spite of clouds of sadness and pain, the enlightened person knows I am okay no matter what. That's it. Let the clouds be there. What harm is it? That's what Sri Krishna's point is with this metaphor. And he gives another metaphor in the next verse. Let's see that. Yata nabho vaivana lambu bhugunaihi. Yata nabho vaivavanana bhugunaihi. Gata gatar vartugunar nasajjate. Sajjate tathaksharam sattvarajastamo malar tathakshara sattvamar aham mate samsriti hetubhi param aham mate samsriti hetubhi param. So here's our second metaphor. First metaphor was the sun is unaffected by clouds. Here the metaphor is nabhas, space. Space is unaffected. Yata, just as. Nabhaha, space, and at the end of the second line, na sajjate. Space, na sajjate, is not affected by what? Vayu. Air, but in this case, wind. Wind blows, how does it affect space? Does space get distorted? Einstein said that space gets distorted by mass. Maybe so, but does wind distort space? No, it doesn't affect it at all. Nor by anala. Anala is fire. When there's a flame in space, does space get heated up? The air maybe gets hot, and you put your finger there, and you'll feel it, but space is unaffected. And then ambu. Ambu is water. So you have to get the right metaphor. How is space affected by water? Water in a form of rain, right? So when it rains, how is space affected? Not at all. And then finally, bhu. Bhu is earth. How is space affected by earth when there's dust in the sky? Space remains utterly unaffected, gunaihi, by the qualities of the wind, the flames, rain or dust. That's a nice metaphor because when something is in your mind, does that affect consciousness? Whatever is in your mind, whether it is vayu, we like to stretch metaphors. So here, stretching the metaphor, vayu, wind, when your mind is agitated, how does that affect consciousness? Anala, when your mind is frustrated, fiery, I won't say anger because I don't know how an enlightened person gets angry. It doesn't really make sense. An enlightened person never feeling threatened. If you don't feel, you can get angry at injustice. There you go. So seeing a terrible injustice, an enlightened person could get angry. Okay? So that anger is burning in the mind of an enlightened person. How does that affect consciousness? Not at all. Or ambu, rain. We associate rainfall with sadness, so that sadness is in the mind, doesn't affect. Dust, dirt, any kind of impurity. How does that affect consciousness? And the metaphor continues, gata agataihi vartu gunaihi. Vartu, season. Vartu gunaihi, the nature or quality of seasons, warm and cold. So warm and cold with the various seasons, that gata and agata, when the seasons change and the temperature changes, how does that affect How does that affect the air in the same way? How is consciousness affected? This is really crucial in Advaita Vedanta because there's a common misconception that being enlightened requires a perfect mind. This is really an important point. If enlightenment requires a perfect mind, forget it. What human being can have a perfect mind? The mind can't be perfected. Your body can't be perfected. Nothing about the human condition can be made perfect. It can be improved. And improving it is good. We should improve. But to make enlightenment, to wrongly assume that enlightenment is the end result of a process of perfecting the mind, this is a common misconception, and it really causes trouble. So if the mind cannot be perfect, then what exactly is enlightenment? And mind cannot be perfect, but knowledge can be perfect. That is to say that you can know your true nature as unchanging consciousness that remains utterly unaffected by any of the nonsense that happens in your mind, in your body, and in the world around you. When you have that knowledge and it's perfectly and completely assimilated, no more suffering. You have the complete absence of suffering. And the complete absence of suffering is a state of perfection. But it's not a state of perfection for the mind. Can enlightened people get headaches? As long as if they have a head. Only if they have a head. Then they can get so. It's a state of perfection referring to Satchitananda Atma, which is always perfect. You discover your true nature as Satchitananda Atma. So this is the drishtanta, the metaphor that comes in the first half, and in the second half comes the darshtanta, what the metaphor represents. And so he begins the first part with yatha, just as nabhis nasajjate, just as space is not affected. In the third line, tatha, in the same way, aksharam na sajjate. Here, akshara, that which is unchangeable, referring to consciousness. That which doesn't decay, that which doesn't get affected. That word sajjate, that comes in the prior half. That consciousness, aksharam, it doesn't get affected by anything. Why? That aksharam is, end of the verse, param. It is, and param can mean supreme. It can also mean beyond. And here, take it in the sense of beyond. That aksharam is beyond, param, beyond what? Beginning of the fourth line. We have to jump around a little bit here. It is beyond aham matehe. It is beyond the aham mati, ego, ahankara. Beyond the limited individual who says, I have a headache. An enlightened person, let's play with this for just a moment. Will an enlightened person say, I have a headache? So first of all, we've already established if an enlightened person still has a head, they are indeed subject to getting headaches. So suppose the enlightened person has a headache and wants you to get some Tylenol for them. So the enlightened person asks you, can you get some Tylenol? And you ask, oh, Swamiji, do you have a headache? And what will you say? Yeah, I have a headache. But now watch this. When the enlightened person says, I, the enlightened person completely understands the fact that I is a pronoun. And the referent of a pronoun is kind of arbitrary. So if an enlightened person says, I, we need a special translation here for an enlightened person. They speak a different language. When the enlightened person says, I have a headache, it means this head hurts. That's what it means. Because the enlightened person knows, I am Satchidananda Atma, unchanging consciousness, and the consciousness because of which this throbbing pain is known. This is the language of an enlightened person. So an enlightened person will use the word I in a conventional way, but without any confusion about it. Generally, you know, I am, look at the confusion, starting with I am male or female. Body is male or female. I'm young or old, body. I am tired or energetic, prana. These are all things we have. It's not who we are. Even if you say, I am agitated or I am calm, those are conditions of your mind. So, but we use that pronoun I so casually and without proper discernment. Look at the difference between these two statements. I am miserable because of this headache versus this head is pounding. So I am miserable because of a headache is a reflection of my, is a statement that expresses my suffering. This head is pounding is a statement of fact. What a difference between a statement of fact and suffering. An enlightened, which led Pujya Swamiji to define enlightenment in this other very strange way, where he said enlightenment is perfect objectivity. And he meant it in this sense. What do you mean by perfect objectivity? It means a fact is a fact, and why get miserable over facts? So whatever is a political situation is a fact. Why should you suffer? Or why should you be elated? It's just a fact. An enlightened person is not going to suffer or get elated over a fact, even a fact of the political climate. So this is what he meant by pure objectivity. So that aksharam, that unchanging consciousness, which is ahammatehi param, beyond the ahankara, that unchanging consciousness, na sajate, we can use that again in the second half, is not affected by what? Sattva, rajas, tamas, malaihi, by the impurities of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Body is made of sattva, rajas, tamas. Mind, sattva, rajas, tamas. Everything about the human condition, sattva, rajas, tamas. None of it affects consciousness, just as nothing affects space. So this sattva, rajas, and tamas, which is, and drop down the final line, samsriti hetubihi. This sattva, rajas, and tamas manifest in the form of a human body and mind is samsriti hetu. It is a hetu, the cause for samsriti samsara, synonym, for worldly life. And life after life, death after death, whatever happens to the body and mind doesn't affect consciousness. So what happens to an enlightened person at death? Nothing, right? An enlightened person is that consciousness. What happens to consciousness at the time of death? You get it. It's just like everything else in life is a fact, death is a fact. Why should you be depressed about a fact? Why should you be elated about facts? When you read a history book and learned that the United States gained its independence from the British in 1776, do you get elated? Or if you're British, do you get depressed? It's just a fact that you get the point. For an enlightened person, it's all facts, and that's why Pooja Swamiji said that is perfect objectivity. Then, next. Yeah. Tathapi sangha parivarjaniyo. Tathapi sangha parivarjaniyo. Guneshu maya rachiteshu tavata. Guneshu maya rachiteshu tavata. Madbhakti yogena dridhena yavata. Madbhakti yogena dridhena yavata. Rajo nirasyeta manakshakashayaha. Rajo virasyeta manakashayaha. We need to introduce this a little bit. So if nothing affects consciousness, whatever happens to your body doesn't affect consciousness, so why bother taking care of it? Eat more donuts. Again, a silly conclusion, but you get the point. If nothing affects you, then who cares? Eat more donuts. If nothing affects consciousness, who cares about what's happening in your mind? Just, what do they say? Eat, drink, and be merry. Good. Wait a minute. That verse was describing whom? An enlightened person? So what we could conclude is, if you really are an enlightened person and you want to eat more donuts, go for it. No harm. No harm to you, consciousness. On the other hand, why would an enlightened person deliberately do something to harm his or her physical body? What is the motive? Have you ever noticed that anything harmful we do to ourselves and others has a motivation driven by desire, right? Whenever we harm ourselves or harm another person, those behaviors, those adharmic behaviors, are driven by desire. And what desire will drive an enlightened person? To harm his or her own body? You get the point. So, an enlightened person is free to eat donuts, but why? Knowing that eating too many donuts is harmful to the body. Donuts, of course, represents anything that's part of an unhealthy lifestyle. So, the prior verses addressed one who is enlightened. Nothing affects consciousness. Now, Sri Krishna says, on the other hand, remember he's having this discussion with his cousin, Uddhava, who's probably not yet enlightened. So Sri Krishna says, tathapi, but still, sangha parivarjaniyaha, sangha, attachment, and all kinds of desires, parivarjaniyaha, should be avoided. To be more clearly, you may want more donuts, but you shouldn't eat more donuts. You don't need to act on that particular desire. That's why he uses the word sangha, attachment. It's when you have raga dvesha and you are driven against your best understanding. Your doctor has told you no more donuts for you. And what do? So that is sangha, that's attachment. Sri Krishna says, sangha parivarjaniyaha, you should avoid, if you're not enlightened, You should avoid the attachment that drives you to these harmful activities. You should avoid attachment to what? Guneshu, to the qualities of objects, or just to objects which are maya rachiteshu, which are part of this world of maya. Maya means the world in which, the world which is not completely unreal, nor is it completely real. So maya refers to this kind of indescribable middle condition. Maya is more real than the elephant in my hand, but less real than my hand. That's the idea. An intermediate state of existence, less real than Brahman, perhaps I should say. So he says, Tavat, as long, you should continue to avoid this attachment, being driven by raga and dvesha to chase after worldly things. Tavat, as long as, and that tavat connects to yavat in the next line, as long as, but now go to the third line, as long as, or until, not as long as, until third, last line, rajas, nirasyeta. Rajas here refers to that driving force of raga and dvesha. What is it that compels you to chase after donuts, to stay with the metaphor? What is it that compels you, maybe not you, but some people, especially children, what is it that compels them to avoid broccoli? Who knows? So what is it that compels you to go after donuts and compels you to run away from broccoli? Sri Krishna says that sangha, that attachment, that drive of raga dvesha, indicated here by rajas. So until that rajas nirasyeta has been removed, you should avoid that attachment. Now, how? And Sri Krishna makes a very some important teaching here. So rajas nirasyeta, you should remove rajas from your mind. Rajas in a sense of raga and dvesha, these compulsions to chase after what you want, to run away from what you don't want, how to get rid of it. And in the third line, he says so beautifully, mad bhakti yogena dridhena. You can get rid of it through mad bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga, devotion, devotional practices to mat, to me, devotional practices which are dridha, very strong, very intense devotional practices to me. This introduces the huge topic of karma yoga, which we'll not get into, but try it like this. Everything you eat, we consider to be an offering to the deity within. So what do you want to eat? Whatever you offer into a havankund, into a sacrificial fire, whatever you offer is going to be transported to the gods, the deities being addressed. In the same way, whatever you eat, this is a metaphor, comes in Bhagavad Gita and elsewhere, whatever you eat is offered to the deity within. So what do you offer into that havankund? You offer ghee, you offer this samagri, different kinds of seeds and things, but things which are pure and holy. Would you take a piece of trash and put it in that havankund? You wouldn't think of it. So what are you putting in here? Donuts. Not generally. But just to make the point, right? So if we have that understanding, put it like this. If you really understand the teachings of Karma Yoga, this body belongs to Ishvara. That's Karma Yoga. This body belongs to Ishvara. So what should you do with this body? You should take care of it, which means putting healthy food inside and avoiding unhealthy food. This is how, you know, he says that you overcome this raga dvesha through bhakti. And here is, again, Karma Yoga is a huge topic, but in our current context, here's just one tiny little example of raga dvesha with regard to our lifestyle. If this is Ishvara's body, then how should we take care of it? It's on loan. You were given this body long ago at the time of your birth, and you possess this body for, you know, another number of years, and then you give it up. So it really is on loan. And a funny observation, you know, if you have a car, you take care of it. But if you are driving your friend's car, your friend loaned you the car, do you take care of your friend's car? You don't bother? In fact, you take care of your friend's car better than you take care of your own car, correct? Because it's been loaned to you by your friend. Your body has been given to you by Bhagavan. We should give it that special care, knowing that this is a gift of Ishvara. Treating this body as a gift of Ishvara, we treat it appropriately, and in this way, we become free from raga dvesha. So this is what, this is just one small, tiny example of Karma Yoga, which means bringing these spiritual teachings into our day-to-day lives, where we are often driven by raga dvesha. So here's how he says, bhakti yogena dirdena. Through bhakti yoga, you can overcome this raga dvesha. This raga dvesha, which he describes with this fascinating word, he says, mana kashayaha. It is a kashaya of the manas. Now, tricky, because the word kashaya has a too many meanings. And you know, some of you are thinking of, I think in South India it's some medicine you drink, right? Not that one. Anyway, it's in the mind, he says, so obviously he's not talking about that. Kashaya is a name for this vastra. Because kashaya can mean a certain the red color. Kashaya can mean red, and by extension, dye. So, kashaya. Kashaya also more commonly simply means dirt or impurity. So, starting with that meaning, the mana kashaya, the impurity of the mind, and the impurity of the mind is certainly raga and dvesha, which leads you to do adharmic deeds. So just be very clear. Why is raga dvesha an impurity? Is raga dvesha natural? We've argued so many times that whatever is natural is, you know, God made it. Ishvara gave us minds that are subject to raga dvesha. That's all normal. But now, when raga dvesha is directed towards something dharmic, there's no problem. There might be problems. If your raga dvesha directs you to buying a brand new state-of-the-art electronic gadget or car or something that's way too costly, then there's some problem to your bank account or your checking account, your credit card balance. There's nothing adharmic about it, assuming that you don't overspend. But the point is that raga dvesha can equal actually drive you towards something adharmic, something that's harmful to yourself and to others. In that way, raga dvesha is an impurity. Remember, impurity here is understood through the lens of dharma and adharma. Anything that leads you on the path of dharma is pure. Anything that leads you away from the path of dharma is impure. So raga dvesha are impure, even though they're normal. They're impure because they can lead you off the path of dharma. Therefore, called kshaya impurity. By the way, the relationship to this dye, kshaya, can also be that which colors something, can also be called kshaya. So this clothing is dyed, and the interesting metaphor of dye is this. This cloth has been washed many, many times, and it's still orange. That tells us something about removing impurities. So impurities in our minds, we remove those impurities many times. Every prayer removes impurities. How about bathing in the Ganga? During the Kumbh Mela now, so many people are bathing in the Ganga. Typical thing, you bathe in the Ganga, fine, you're cleared of all your sins, all the impurities. But then, the moment you step out of the Ganga, guess what happens? You start collecting new impurities. We all know that. Those of you who do laundry know it better than most of us. So you get clean clothes. Actually, we all wear clean clothes. How long do they stay clean? Before long, they need to be laundered again. So this is the problem of impurity. Some impurities are like dye, and they just stay there, and it's really, really hard. I suppose if you wash this another 100 times, it'll be a bunch of threads. But you get the idea. Eventually, the dye does go. So, but it goes slowly. And we're talking about removing impurities. And the point here is, even the most deeply embedded impurities in our minds can be removed, but it may take some time, some effort. How many times should you bathe in the Ganga? Not just once is kind of the idea. And then the other observation from this interesting word, manakshaya, the other observation is, even after removing impurities, you get more that come back. And that is the idea that we'll see this one more verse, because the next verse talks about this. You remove impurities and they come back. You wash your clothes, and then next week you have to wash them again. And a week after that, you have to keep doing that. And Sri Krishna talks about this problem in this next verse. He says, tatamayo sadhu vichikshito nranam yatamayo sadhu chikshito nranam punah punah santurati prarohan punah Puna santurati prahohan evam mano pakva kshaya karma evam mano pakva kshaya karmam kuyoginam vidyati sarva sangam kuyoginam vidyati sarva sangam. So he gives an example to describe this process. This process of removing impurities. So I joked with you, how many times, let's put it in a different context. How many times should you jump in the Ganga, I'm being a little sarcastic, bathe in the Ganga? How many times should you take a sacred bath in the holy Ganga to become enlightened? And you can answer that question. So it doesn't work that way. And that's what Sri Krishna describes here. He says, yatha is just like amayaha. Amaya means illness, physical illness in this case. Just as physical illness, nrinam, at the end of the line, of a person, of people. So if the physical illness of a person is asadhu, chikitsitaha, treated by some medicine, by some doctor. But if it's treated how, asadhu, sadhu means well, properly. Asadhu, not properly treated. So if a person's illness is not properly treated, and think of how many medical professionals we have here. So you know this better than you might know this better than Sri Krishna, because he no MD degree. All right. So when an illness is improperly treated, then what happens? Punaha, again and again, prarohan, it advances, and santudati, it afflicts the person again and again. So that illness improperly treated, prarohan, it re-emerges, and santudati makes a person suffer again and again. Why? We know this so well. The underlying problem has not been treated. And this happens a lot. The symptoms are treated and not the underlying problem. This happens not only in medical care. It happens when we want to be free from suffering. We keep doing these little things which make our lives a little bit more comfortable. And then we're comfortable for a few days, and then the suffering comes back. We do something more, we're comfortable again, and then the suffering comes back. We do something more. That cycle continues and continues. We do things to remove our misery, and it keeps coming back because we haven't treated the underlying problem. So Sri Krishna describes it in this way. He says, evam, in the same way, man, by the editor here, has made a mistake. By the way, who is the editor? The editor should have put navagraha here. Mana, mano, avagraha. Because, breaking it apart, it's manas apakva. If you lose that a, you got the opposite meaning. So manas apakva kashaya karma. For a mind that is apakva kashaya karma. A mind whose kashaya, impurities, and associated karmas, when there's impurities, it drives raga dvesha. Raga dvesha leads to actions. So all of that, if all of that is apakwa, literally uncooked is what it means, but if it has not been fully removed from the mind, is the context here. A mind which is apakwa, raw, uncooked, unrefined, unbathed, you could say, full of impurities. For such a mind, what happens is then that mind, vidyati, in the verb in the next line, that mind, a mind from which those impurities of raga and dvesha have not been removed, what does that mind do? Vidyati. There are several meanings here. Vid in the sense of vidhi, a rule or command. So here, that mind, vidyati, controls who? Or afflicts, it can also mean. That mind afflicts whom? And here's an interesting word. Bhikkhu Yoginam. Yogi, you know, as a spiritual practitioner. So Yoginam Vidyati. It afflicts a yogi. Why? A yogi who is a Ku Yogi. Most of you know in Sanskrit, Su is a prefix for good. Ku is the other one. So Ku Yogi means I don't know, maybe a hypocritical yogi, somebody who pretends to do a lot of spiritual practices. And Sri Krishna makes it very clear, this Ku Yogi is one who is Sarva Sangam, who is attached to everything. So someone who has yet to undergo a process of removing these impurities, removing the impurity of raga dvesha, the impurities of raga dvesha that Sri Krishna says very beautifully, they're removed through devotion to me, recognizing all this is Ishvara. Just a final statement. If you get it, all this is Ishvara, how can you get away with an adharmic action? How would you even consider doing an adharmic action if this body is Ishvara? You're not going to do an adharmic action. If your mind is Ishvara, you're not going to belittle yourself. If your obnoxious neighbor is Ishvara, you're going to shout at him. If your angry boss is Ishvara, I told myself long ago, stop picking on mothers-in-law. So it's not fair, right? It's not fair. So it's really, really, you know, this is traditionally, this is the joke everyone tells. It is not fair. Come on. But if you really get it that all of this is Ishvara, how about the planet? Planet is Ishvara. How much garbage do we produce, which goes into landfills? How much petrochemicals do we use, all of which contributes to global warming? You get the point that karma yoga, based on this understanding, all this is Ishvara, radically transforms your life and leads to a whole different attitude. All this is Ishvara. And it's not just an idea or a concept. You've all been exposed to these teachings sufficiently to know. When the ancient Rishi said, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, all this is Ishvara. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam, all of this is included in Ishvara. How many times do we find that statement in our scriptures? When those statements transform your mind, living a life of sadhana becomes easy. So that's the key. And that's why we keep going with these teachings to bring about that transformation of our mind. This is a good place to conclude today. A couple of announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our Vedanta class at 10 o'clock. Satsang, question and answers at 11. Please come and join us. And then this coming Wednesday at 7 p.m., we have our advanced meditation class. If you already know how to meditate, come and join us. We'll conclude with our prayers. Om Ganana Hantwa Ganapatigam Avamahe Kavinga Vinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanas Patahana Shrenvan Utabhisida Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Guru Dhatmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanuramardhanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat.